Okay, welcome back, everybody. We are in our, I guess this is our fourth session now on Way of the Ascetics. And we are starting in chapter 6. As I mentioned earlier before we started recording, I'm going to try to do 6, 7, and 8. Y'all are all probably thinking, yeah, right. And I am too deep down, but I'm still, you know, hope springs eternal, right? You know, maybe the Astros will actually win the pennant this year. No, I mean, it's possible. It's conceivable.
You're dreaming.
That's right, yeah, miracles. Miracles do happen. So I'm going to read the chapter, so if you have the book, follow along. If you don't, just listen. And this one's pretty short, so I'll just read it real quick, and then we'll talk about it. And we'll follow the same format we've been doing. I'll read the chapter, and then I'll present some of my reflections or thoughts on it, and then we'll have some discussion or questions. Okay, it's chapter 6. This is a tough one. It's called On Eradicating the Desire for Enjoyment. Here you go. It is said that only a few find the narrow way that leads to life, and that we must strive to enter by the narrow door. For many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in and shall not be able. Luke 13:14. The explanation is to be found precisely in our unwillingness to persecute ourselves. We overcome after a fashion perhaps our serious and dangerous vices, but there it stops. The small desires we freely let grow as they will. We neither embezzle nor steal, but delight in gossiping. We do not drink, but consume immoderate quantities of tea and coffee. Again, there he goes again. I'll tell you, he's out to get me. The heart, yeah, have another cup. The heart remains quite as full of appetites. The roots are not pulled out, and we wander around the tangled woods that have sprung up in the soil of our self-pity. Make an onslaught on your self-pity, for it is the root of all ill that befalls you. If you were not full of self-pity, you would soon observe that we ourselves are to blame for all this evil, because we refuse to understand that it is in reality a good thing. Commiserating yourself obscures your sight. You are compassionate only for yourself, and as a result, your horizon closes in. Your love is bound up with yourself. Set it free, and it departs from you. Suppress your ruinous weakness and your craving for comfort. Attack them from every side. Crush your desire for enjoyment. Do not give it air to breathe. Be strict with yourself. Do not grant your carnal ego the bribes it is restively demanding. For everything gains strength from repetition, but dies if it is not given nourishment. But take care not to bar the front entrance to evil, and at the same time to leave a back door ajar, through which it can cleverly slip in another form. How do you benefit if, for example, you begin to sleep on a hard mattress, but instead indulge in warm baths? Or if you try to give up smoking, but give free rein to your urge to prattle? Or if you deny your urge to prattle, but read exciting novels? Or if you stop reading novels, but let loose your imagination and quiver in sweet melancholy? All these are only different forms of the same thing. Your insatiable craving to satisfy your own need for enjoyment. You must set about rooting out the very desire to have things pleasant, to get on well, to be contented. You must learn to like sadness, poverty, pain, hardship. You must learn to follow privately the Lord's bidding, not to speak empty words, not to adorn yourself, always to obey authority, not to look at a woman with desire, nor to be angry, and much else. For all these biddings are given us not in order for us to act as if they did not exist, but for us to follow. Otherwise the Lord of mercy would not have burdened us with them. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, he said, Matthew 16:24, thereby leaving it to each person's own will. If any man will, and to each person's endeavor, let him deny himself. All right, and as I already mentioned, that's the end of the chapter. This is one of the toughest chapters in the book, maybe the toughest. In it, Colander makes some very strong statements that are very tough for the average Christian, especially in the West, to take. So I'm going to make an attempt to explain. Excuse me, probably won't be a very good one, but I'm going to give it a shot. Most of us who live in the industrialized democracies of the West are very pampered people. We don't think we are, but we really are. We rarely, if ever, go without the things we need, do we? Every once in a great while, but not usually. Moreover, we constantly indulge ourselves with luxuries and fancy cars, expensive vacations, fine foods and drink, usually in too great quantities, $4 cups of coffee and so on. These things are not evil in and of themselves, but if not checked and controlled, they can make us soft, both spiritually and physically. And as we saw in chapter 3, the fathers of the church teach us that if we are to advance in the path towards salvation, we should not constantly pamper ourselves. Instead, we should, in the words of Isaac the Syrian, Saint Isaac the Syrian, and this was quoted also in the book here in this chapter, persecute ourselves In other words, we should discipline ourselves by denying ourselves excessive pleasure. Along with this, we must also deny ourselves the right to engage in the smaller sins or even non-sinful excesses. We saw that Colliander said, "We overcome after a fashion perhaps our serious and dangerous vices, but there it stops. The small desires we let freely grow as they will," and so on. Then we had the part about, you know, we don't do this, but we do this. We don't do this. We don't, none of us in here are serial murderers, are we? So I hope not. If you are, please talk to me afterward. none of us are probably, none of us in this room right now, and probably nobody listening to this on the internet, are what the world would consider great sinners. You know, we're not going to be thrown in jail for something anytime soon. But we still have a tendency to let little things that maybe the world considers acceptable, but God does not consider acceptable. And we let those fester within us and grow, and they become big problems. And he talked about self-pity. Did you notice that reference? He says, "To make an assault on your self-pity, for it is the root of all the ill that befalls you. You are compassionate only for yourself, and as a result, your horizon closes in. Your love is bound up with yourself. Set it free, and evil departs from you." The main problem with self-pity is that it is totally focused on self. The pity part, you know, is good if it's focused on others. Pity can be good, but not if it's focused entirely on yourself. We lose perspective when all we can think about is how our needs are not being met. And then, speaking about the desire for comfort, Colliander says, "Suppress your ruinous weaknesses and your craving for comfort. Attack them from every side." I love this military language. This crush your desire for enjoyment. Do not give it air to breathe. Be strict with yourself. Do not grant your carnal ego the bribes it is restively demanding. For everything gains strength from repetition, but it does if it it dies if it is not given nourishment. And then Colliander gives this advice from the Holy Fathers. He says, "You must set about rooting out the very desire to have things pleasant, to get on well, to be contented." And then he says something really tough. In fact, when I first read this, I put a big question mark off to the side because I wasn't really sure I understood it. I'm still not sure I understand it. But he says, "You must learn to like sadness, poverty, pain, hardship." He doesn't just say you need to learn to put up with it, to deal with it. You need to learn to like it. "You must learn to follow privately the Lord's bidding, not to speak empty words," and so on and so on. Now, think about that. Learn to like sadness, poverty, pain, hardship. Now, that's tough, isn't it? What do the fathers mean when they say this kind of thing? And this is my understanding of it, and I'll get your thoughts on it as well. I think we should welcome these things because they drive us toward total and complete dependence on God. Or at least they can and should. You know, great hardship kind of has a polarizing effect on people. Some people, it drives them away from God. I think about my father. My father was raised in the Methodist Church. He went every Sunday. You know, he heard the gospel. He sang the hymns. But then he was in World War II, and he saw, you know, he was in the Pacific campaign, and if you've read anything about that, most of y'all know something at least. It was very, very hard. Very, you know, just awful. If you didn't get killed by a bullet or a shell or something, you were going to get a disease probably. And he saw so many people that he really liked, you know, really good people just die. You know, he would say to me, you know, "Well, all these really good people I knew died, and then all these jerks got to live." And it drove him away from God. You know, he had a real issue with the goodness of God from that for the rest of his life. But other people, hardship drives them toward God. So that's what I think he's talking about here in that our chief desire must be to grow closer to God, ever closer, increasingly taking on His character rather than to have things pleasant or well or contented, as Colliander says. And so that we should be willing to welcome whatever it takes, you know. I'm just thinking about this commercial. I just put a thing on my blog that you all know about Menin Skin Bracer, right? Mm-hmm. Skin Bracer by Menin, you know, one of those $2 aftershaves that you get in the drugstore, you know. Easy. And you remember in the 70s they had easy.
Yeah, I use a cheap stuff.
Actually, I do too.
I just drink a $4 coffee.
Yeah. Yeah. He's saving money, that's right. No, there's nothing wrong with Skin Bracer. But I like the commercials from the 70s. Do you remember that? The guy would pour some in his hands, and then he'd go, "Wah, wah, thanks, thanks, I needed that," you know? And it's kind of almost that idea. Go to my blog. There was a really funny one that I didn't even know existed. I didn't remember. I put that on there. Of course, I was a little kid when this came out, you know, so the memory's a little bit fuzzy, but it's not that we should be masochists and say, oh, yes, God, hurt me, you know, nothing like that. But you know, we should be willing to say to God, I will do whatever it takes. And sometimes, you know, slap, slap, we do need that, don't we? Sometimes we need a little slapping, all of us. And so that, I think that's the kind of the idea that he has in mind here. What do you guys think? Or any questions or thoughts? Christine?
I'm having trouble processing all of this. Not just this individual chapter, mm-hmm. but as a whole.
Right.
And how it translates to daily life.
Right.
Because, I mean, I, you know, being a mother, having children and a family, I cannot be an ascetic. You know, I can't live this
right.
perfect life. I will never attain this. I will never reach it. And so when he says, persecute yourself, deny yourself everything.
Mm-hmm. No, he didn't say everything.
Humble.
Did he say everything?
Pleasure, enjoyment, coffee, food, drink, everything.
No, he said you could have one cup of coffee.
My point is, I don't know how. And then in later, I don't know if it's before or after in the chapter where it says, deny yourself running errands and doing busy things. Next chapter. And I feel like that's sometimes all my life is running errands and doing little things around the house and chores and things like that. So I don't know how to take that and run with it. I don't know what to do with it.
I think as a mother, you're doing these things. Mm-hmm. Very little are you doing it for yourself.
Yeah.
You're doing it for your husband. You're doing it for your children. You're denying yourself constantly. Yeah. I mean, if you really wanted to deny yourself, you would. If you didn't want to deny yourself, you would have had children. Just the act of having a child, you're automatically entering into a at least a 20-year road of denial.
Yeah.
Like, <you're>
not.
Yeah. After that, I don't know.
Yeah. I agree totally with Shannon. He gives specific examples here. He's not saying. You should never. I don't. If he were here right now, you know, and we could interview the author, I don't think he's saying you should never have two cups of coffee. You should never run an errand. You should never sleep on a soft mattress or whatever. What Shannon said has a lot of wisdom. The path of asceticism is not the exact same thing for all of us. The whole point of it all is deny yourself. And like he said, I agree totally with you. You are already doing that because you are giving your life in service to others. You're not pampering yourself. You're not pleasing yourself. So what I would encourage everybody is not to take these as laws, you know, or commandments that, you know, if we have two cups of coffee, then we're a sinner. Or if, you know.
If you're a monk in the monastery, you might be doing this literally all the time.
Yeah. But your path of asceticism is not going to be the same as mine. And certainly neither one of us will be the same as St. Isaac the Syrian, for example, or a modern day monk.
Gary and I were talking about this morning, and he said, like, sleeping on a hard mattress and taking a warm bath. If you say, okay, I'm going to sleep on a hard mattress, don't fill in that with a warm bath. Okay, because I'm going to sleep on a hard mattress, now I'm going to indulge myself and take a warm bath. So it's not, if you're going to give something up, give it up and replace it with something that's, you know, godly or, you know, that will help you, but not something that pleases you.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I struggle with that mattress issue because that comes up in more than one work of the fathers, you know. And if I were to sleep on the floor, for example, I would just be a total grump the next day, wouldn't I? And my wife says, "Amen." But it would make it very hard for me to be kind and loving and all that. That's going to come up later. There's going to be some chapters later on. He's going into a lot of detail about deny yourself and focus on God. And then later he's going to talk about prayer, fasting, obedience, humility, more practical day-by-day things. So don't lose hope. Don't give up. It's some of this is hard to take, but just remember that, again, that the whole point of it is to not pamper yourself, to try to work on your own, not just physical comfort and all that, but things like the pride within you, you know, the anger that is within you that comes out sometimes. Those are the things that we really need to persecute above all else. Who else had something? Look, that hard mattress is getting to you. I'm kidding. That's hard to do.
Does it really just all kind of translate to humility? I mean...
Well, that's a big part of it. That's a big part of it. And pride, just and self. He talked about self-pity here. You know, it's like, I like what you said, Sharon. You know, if we fast, you know, we keep all the rules of the fast, and then we say, oh man, poor me, I just feel so bad. And it's hard not to, especially when you get to the fifth week. And it's like, okay, wait a minute, Junior Mints are legal. Somebody need two boxes of Junior Mints in one sitting. You know, it's like I said, if we replace indulging in hamburgers and pizza and all that with just indulging in something else, if we exchange overeating one type of food to a different type of food, even though it's a little bit healthier, we haven't gained anything. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I think that I'm not trying to get anybody off the hook, including myself, by saying, no, we don't have to do this. This mm-hmm. doesn't really mean that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that we can probably, if we're not careful when he says, like sadness, mm-hmm. like the sacrifice, we can start being very prideful about that.
Yeah.
And be doing it for the wrong reason. And I mean, I have been around somebody in my lifetime that had what I consider to be a martyr complex. And I mean, you know, they were constantly giving and giving and giving, but they were wearing it on their sleeve mm-hmm. all the time, and they were unbearable to live with. I've seen a lot of mothers that way. They tell you how, oh, I'm so self-sacrificing. I've done this for you. I've done that. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they were truly just wrapped up in being a good mom. They were wanting to get the accolades to go along with it. Or don't you feel sorry for me because I'm doing all these things? Mm-hmm. And so I mean, I think there's a danger of doing that. But I'm
absolutely.
Sorry, I don't know your name. I can relate with what Christine was saying because of not this study in itself, but just generally, because when I read the Bible and I hear Jesus say, do this, do this, do this, and they're very simple and to the point things, uh-huh. and then I say, well, how can I not be materialistic? How can I not do that? And then I talk to someone for advice, and they say, well, you live in the world, you can't do that totally.
Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, Jesus said right here.
Uh-huh.
So, but we're always trying to take ourselves off the hook. We're always
right.
trying to find a way and say, well, he didn't really mean that.
Right.
Well, I think maybe he did. Uh-huh. And I think maybe we need to find yeah. a way to do it. But again, getting to this, maybe if we just kind of attack it a little bit at a time, we don't feel like we're doing much. But then a year or two later, we look at ourselves and say, gee, I'm not nearly as self-centered as I used to be. So obviously, somewhere along the line, I've been doing something right.
Right.
Rather than, you know, trying to do it all at once. You know.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's about progress.
That goes back to chapter 5, where he tells us to begin in small things. Uh-huh. But even the small things need to begin in small steps. Small things.
Right. Yeah, I remember, you know, I said a couple weeks ago or maybe last week that I think a good thing to do during Lent is to make one major goal at least. You know, make one goal like this Lent I will not go nuclear with my children or something like that, you know, or with my husband and really focus on that. Focus on, say, anger management. And
next year.
Next year, yeah. Too late. Great idea for next year, and then work on that, and then, you know, and then try to maintain that throughout the year. That's the whole point of Lent, is to get us really focusing on something so that hopefully we'll maintain that new level of spiritual maturity throughout the rest of the year, not so we drop it and then start over the next year.
We have three more fasting periods, too.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, it's not just Lent. Let's move on to the next chapter, chapter 7. Yeah, we do have to, you know, we do have to keep this in perspective, keep a balance between the fact that this is not Holy Scripture, you know, these are not the Scriptures, these are not the words of our Lord, they're one man's, I guess, his distillation, his summarization of what the teaching of the fathers were, which in those in of itself, those are trying to apply the gospel to our lives. So we don't want to let ourselves totally off the hook on everything and say, oh, none of this applies to me, but at the same time, we don't want to say, oh, I'm not doing any of this, so I'm not. I don't love God, I guess.
Can I just have one more thing?
Yeah, yeah.
I was reading A Night on the Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the whole title, but you know what I'm talking about.
Which one? Is this the one?
Yeah.
It's a Night on the Mountain.
Bishop Herotheos.
Oh, okay. All right.
But anyway, so the priest is talking to the monk, and I mentioned this to a couple of people already because it did me some good, I think. But the priest is saying, I can't pray all the time. I can't do all these things you're talking about doing. And the monk said, well, in my life, this is my life. This is what I do. I can do this all day. In your life, since you've got so many other things, it may mean as much to the Lord if you spend 30 minutes a day praying as it does if I spend all day.
Right.
So maybe that's kind of the approach.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. Chapter 7, on the transfer of love from the self to Christ. He says, this is page 20, if we move out of ourself, who do we encounter? Asks Bishop Theophon. He supplies the answer at once. We meet God and our neighbor. It is for this very reason that denying oneself is a stipulation, and the chief one, for the person who seeks salvation in Christ. Only so can the center of our being be moved from self to Christ, who is both God and our neighbor. You know what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to break this up a little. This is another reason why it's so important to deny ourselves. It's not just an end in of itself. Denying ourselves is not just so we're tougher, you know, or we're, you know, better people or whatever. It's because that way we can transfer that care and that concern and that love that we tend to lavish on ourselves, we can transfer that to the person to whom it truly belongs, the Lord Jesus Christ. See, if we're not always, pampering ourselves, if we focus less on self, then we have more attention to focus to Christ. And then when we focus on Christ, we can truly focus on our fellow person as well, our neighbor. We can really begin to love our neighbor. Let me read on. This means that the care, concern, and love that we now lavish on ourselves is then quite naturally and without our noticing it transferred to God and thereby to our fellow men. Only so is the left hand kept from knowing what the right hand doeth, and your alms are actually given in secret. Until this come to pass, we cannot be filled with all knowledge, able also to admonish one another in a real non-material way. Our attempts along this line must be false because they are our own and they spring from our will to please ourselves. It is especially necessary to understand this, for otherwise we become easily confused on the road of specious helpfulness and smug well-being that leads inevitably to the swamp of self-satisfaction. Okay, now, to the person who might say, well, I really am dedicated to Christ and my neighbor. Just look at all the activities that I'm involved in. Okay? And I really don't think he's talking about things you have to do. Taking care of children is something we have to do. You know, paying your taxes is something you have to do. And a lot more now. And, you know, there's things that we have to do. But a lot of us get over-involved in a lot of things that we really don't have to do, don't we? This is what he says, and this is on page 21. He says, refrain from busying yourself, therefore, with charity bazaars, sewing meetings, and other such occupations. And I think he probably means over-busying yourself. He's not saying that none of these are good. Busyness over many things is, in all its form, chiefly a poison. Look within, examine yourself accurately, and you observe that many of these are apparently self-giving deeds spring from a need to deafen your conscience. That is, from your uncontrollable habit of satisfying and pleasing yourself. No, the God of love and peace and complete sacrifice does not care to live in the midst of bustling and ado to please oneself, even if this is carried on perhaps under some kind of pretense. Okay? There is one way to make a test. If your peace of mind is troubled, if you become dejected or perhaps a little angry for some reason, you have to give up performing the good deed you have planned. Then you know that the spring was muddy. Okay? Again, he's not saying we should never involve ourselves in acts of charity and service. Obviously, that's the exact opposite of the gospel, isn't it, to say that. Matthew 25, you know, the parable of the sheep and the goats, says that we must serve, we must do what we can. We must do what we can to help those who are less fortunate than us. But we got to keep two things in mind when we do good works. First, we should not get so busy and involved with serving others that we neglect the inner life of prayer, worship, and spiritual reading. You know, there's a lot of folks who would rather spend hours and hours and hours doing charitable deeds and good works than 30 minutes in prayer. You know, think about the story of Mary and Martha. You know, when Martha was busy with serving and the Lord was there and Mary was just sitting at his feet. And Martha basically said, look at this woman, Jesus. Look at my sister. She's just sitting there doing nothing. And this is a paraphrase. It's one of those crazy new translations. No, but she was kind of hoping Jesus would say, oh, yeah, you're right. Get up and go to the kitchen. You know, get to work. But he said the exact opposite, didn't he? He said, Martha, you're distracted with much serving. Mary has chosen the better portion. So there's a time for service, but there's a time also for just spending time with God, spending time in worship, spending time in prayer, okay? Sitting at the feet of the Lord, going into your room and closing the door, as Jesus says. We don't want to get so busy that we just don't have time. And not just for prayer and worship, but I think we all need some time just for ourselves. We need time to be able to sit down, relax, read a book, and just, you know, start to say, have a cup of coffee. Have a cup of tea or something, but I don't know. No, my point is we need to not be so busy that we're so fragmented and so crazy. You know, so many families today with multiple kids, you know, you got the trap of, okay, we've got soccer this night, we've got ballet, and we've got piano, and we've got this and that and the other. I mean, my family, we made a conscious decision not to do that from the get-go. We just said, we're not going to have every kid in three activities running around nonstop all the time. And our kids don't do as much stuff as other kids do their age. They tend to not. But we have more time together as a family, you know, which is important too. You know, we need to have time to sit down with our children or with our spouse or with whoever, with friends if we're single, and talk about spiritual things. The second trap we can fall into is we should not do works of service so that others will see us. I'm sorry, I got stuck there. I got stuck on the S. Will see us and praise us. Remember Matthew 6:1-4, when Jesus says, "Do not do your acts of service in order to, don't blow the trumpet and do it in front of people so that they'll praise you." Our acts of service must be balanced with worship, prayer, and scripture reading. They must be done solely out of love for Christ and our fellow man. When we live by these principles, we are following the example of Christ Himself. It's like Gary was mentioning earlier. We don't want to do our things and just say, oh, you know, I give myself so much. And some people get so busy so as to attract other people's praise or their pity sometimes. Oh, you poor thing. Okay? Now, let me just finish up my stuff and then we'll talk about it. Let me read this real quick. Perhaps you ask why. Those who are experienced answer, external hindrance and opposition meet only the person who has not yielded his own will to God. And for God, an obstacle is unthinkable. A truly unselfish act is not mine, but God's. It cannot be obstructed. Only for my own plans, my own wishes to study, to work, to rest, to eat, or do a service to my fellow man can some external circumstance get in the way, and then I am grieved. But for the person who has found the narrow way that leads to life, that is, to God, there is only one conceivable hindrance, and that is his own sinful will. If he now wishes to do something but is not permitted to carry it out, how can he grieve? For the rest, he is not making any plans. But this is another of the saint's secrets. Do not be deceived. A Christian ought himself also to walk even as he walked, meaning Jesus, who did not seek his own will, but was born on straw, fasted 40 days, watched in prayer long nights through, healed the sick, drove out evil spirits, had no place to lay his head, and finally let himself be spat upon, scourged, and crucified. Think about how far you are from that. Ask yourself continually anew, have I watched in prayer a single night? Have I fasted a single day? Have I driven out a single evil spirit? And I would say that don't think of that necessarily as some demon or something floating through the air. Maybe the evil within us. Have we driven that out? Have I unresistingly let myself be insulted and beaten? Have I truly crucified the flesh and not sought my own will? Keep this freshly in mind. Now, here's the last couple paragraphs that I think are really important, especially important. For what is denying oneself? He who truly denies himself does not ask, am I happy or shall I be satisfied? All such questions fall away from you if you truly deny yourself. For by so doing, you have also given up your will for either earthly or heavenly happiness. This obstinate will to personal happiness is the cause of unrest and division in your soul. Give it up and work against it. The rest will be given you without effort. All right. Thoughts? Questions? Let me think about that. Transferring the love from self to Christ. That's the main idea there. Wow.
A lot of things.
A lot of things? Oh, go ahead.
I say a lot of these virtues, attributes, come into play to personal relationships with my husband and my wife. Not always doing what I want to do for my own enjoyment. Do what the other one wants to do. What the other person needs. And then my own will get met, usually. So, in your case, when you're doing for children, if you have their mind, they have, I'm doing this for Christ and the other person, then it becomes a ministry, and it also is part of the bond in marriage, or the bond between children and parents.
Yeah. And motherhood is a great ministry. I think moms are my heroes, really, because imagine, we see what happens in families. Not that fathers are, chopped liver or something. I mean, they're essential too. But think what happens when the mother doesn't do her job in a family. We've seen the example of it. So many messed up people because either mom or dad checked out and didn't do their job. It's a ministry, Raising children in the admonition, the fear of the Lord is something that we're called to do. And that is, there's almost no greater display of selflessness to be a good parent, to give up yourself to your children. Yes?
It's hard for me to think about doing something that is good, but it not being for the glory of God. Okay, so maybe I'm doing something good, but it's something for me. And I'm not doing it for God. So it's still a good work.
Right.
But for me, it's not a good thing.
Right.
That's kind of hard to think about.
Okay. What do you mean?
If I do a good thing,
yeah.
It's a good thing. And sometimes we do things, we don't feel like doing it, but we do it anyway because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
I guess I think about when I do that, I don't feel like doing this, but I know I need to, so I'm going to go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, I think about doing that, being selfless.
Right.
Okay. Maybe I'm not. Maybe I'm doing that because it's going to make me feel better for doing
well,
it.
Well, I think...
I'm not doing it for...
I think when we do something good, a good deed, primarily for the purpose of... ourselves, ultimately, making ourselves feel good or having others praise us or something, then that tarnishes it. It's a good deed is a good deed. I mean, it's still good. But I think we lose some of the blessing from it if we're kind of hoping that we'll get something back in return, whether it's praise from somebody or a warm, fuzzy feeling. And not that that warm, fuzzy feeling is bad. I mean, God has programmed us to where we do gain satisfaction. We do feel good when we help others. We do good things. But we just don't want to make ourselves be the focus of it. We want to make the other person or the other, whatever, whoever we're helping them be the focus.
Isn't that the purpose of this chapter? I mean, it's trying to say that all good things come from the Lord, not from you. So if you're taking pride in it, you're feeling hurt, then it's coming from you.
Right.
Because if you're wanting to do something good and then you're disappointed because you don't get to feel good about it, then it's coming from you. And instead, if it doesn't happen, you ought to be saying, and I will be done.
Right.
And just going on, saying, well, I guess the Lord didn't want this good thing to happen.
Well spoken. And sometimes when we do good things, you heard the old phrase, no good deed goes unpunished. We don't always get the reaction we thought we would get. Sometimes we do get insulted, not probably not literally spit upon, maybe, but just people don't. And that is, Jesus said, do good to others without expecting good in return. Okay. And again, if we're doing our good deeds so that I want to hear that person tell me what a great guy I am, Then that's an impure motive. But if we do it just no matter what happens, I'm going to do this, I'm going to help this person because I love God. That's the goal. Okay? And you're right. It does ultimately come from God. God is the one who gives us the ability to do that. All right, if y'all don't mind, I want to just try to get through 8 real quick. This is a very important one, and I I can really relate to this one because this happens to me all the time. And before we actually read the chapter, I'm going to preface it by, I'm going to bring to your mind a story from the Old Testament. You remember Joshua? You know, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho. Jericho. Well, you remember what he did after Jericho? Everybody knows about Jericho. The walls came a tumbling down. But after Jericho, the next city they had to attack was called Ai, it's spelled Ai. I don't know if you pronounce it I, or I always call it Ai, but I just spell it out. But anyway, they went and they attacked it, and it was a total disaster because of a couple of things. I won't go into a lot of detail. One, they had somebody within the camp who had stolen some idols or something like that, and the other was they didn't do it according to God's plan. And the third thing is it's usually pretty dumb just to attack a fortified city head-on, like if you think of it militarily. Now, God obviously overcame that, can overcome that, but God wasn't in this. They didn't do it God's way, so they had many people killed. Now they're going to attack it a second time. Joshua went back to God, and he asked, you know, why did this happen? And God told him what happened, and then Joshua was a little bit humbled and repented, and now he's going to do it by God's plan. This is what they did. He divided his army. A la Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee would have been proud. In fact, he probably got his... Robert E. Lee used to do that all the time, and it usually worked real well. But Joshua divided the army. He put half of it in front of the city and half of it behind the city. Do you remember this story? The division in front of the city, again, stormed it head on. You know, and they got in, and then they started getting beat back a little, and then they got beat back more, so they started to retreat. Well, the army of Ai left the city and went out to pursue them, to chase them. And when they did that, guess what happened? The second half from the rear came in and took over the city. The people of Ai got so cocky because they thought, well, we beat them once already. Now they're doing the exact same thing again, and we're going to go out this time and completely crush them and destroy them. And as a result, they left their city completely undefended and they lost the city. This tactic has been repeated many, many times in the 3,000 years since the Battle of Ai. Usually with the same result. But see, the lesson for us is that the demons attack us in the same way. Okay? One demon will attack us in one way, or one temptation will come to us, and we'll fight it off. And we'll go, yes, I'm bad. You know, I did it. Thank you. Or even if we say thank you, Jesus, we get so excited. And then all of a sudden, boom, oh, somebody gets us from behind. We let down our guard, don't we? We have a tendency to do that. We leave ourselves open to another attack. Tito Coleander warns us in this chapter not to do that. Okay, let's look at the beginning of the chapter. I don't know if I'll read the entire chapter, but I'll read selections from it. Let's just do that for lack of time. At the beginning of the chapter in verse 24, he says, not verse 24, page 24. Yeah. Chapter, you want chapter and verse?
Yes.
Okay. The first time you are victorious over self may be assigned to you. Now I am on the way. But do not consider yourself virtuous. I'm sorry. Only thank God. For it was He who gave you the power. And do not rejoice beyond measure, but swiftly go on. Otherwise the vanquished evil may come to life and conquer you from the rear. Okay? And what I would say to that is, in our struggle to salvation, we encounter many defeats, but we have many victories, don't we? Sometimes we do win the battle. In order to make our victories last, though, we must not let our defenses down, as did this army of Ai. Our enemy, the devil, is relentless. In 1 Peter 5:8, it says that he walks around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Unlike us, the demons do not sleep. They don't get tired. Their attacks continue. St. Peter warns us in the same passage. He says, be sober and be vigilant. Be vigilant. That's one of the main themes of the Philokalia too. It's be vigilant. There's a term in Greek called nephesis, which means watchfulness or vigilance. We've got to always be on the lookout. And that is very hard to do. Very hard to do. Has anybody ever here been in the military and pulled guard duty? I haven't, but I've heard it's very hard. You know, just sit there and watch and watch and watch for hours at a time. But you have to. In the ancient world, you know what happened to sentries that fell asleep, right? Yeah. Now they just put you in the brig, but back then they put you out for good. Coleander writes, let's see, where did I get this from? I didn't write the page number down, but it's either in 24 or 25. He says, once again, be silent. No, before that. Always the next phase of the battle is already waiting. We must constantly be prepared. There's no time to rest. But how can we do this? This is what he says. This is on page 25 now. He says, once again, be silent. Let no one notice what you are about. You are working for the invisible one. Let your work be invisible. And then he says, if you scatter crumbs around you, they are willingly picked up by birds sent by the devil, the saints explain. Beware of self-satisfaction. In one mouthful it can devour the fruit of much toil. Therefore the Father's counsel, act with discernment. Of two evils one chooses the lesser. If you were in private, take the poorest morsel. And if anyone is looking, you should take the middle way that arouses the least notice. Keep hidden and as inconspicuous as possible. In all circumstances, let this be your rule. Do not talk about yourself or how you slept, what you dreamed, or what happened to you. Do not state your views unasked. Do not touch upon your own wants and concerns. All such talk only nourishes your self-preoccupation. Have you ever had a conversation with somebody and you talk to them and you get like three or four words out and then they immediately jump in and they say, well, I thought such and such, or I. It's always that. I hate talking to people that always want to turn the conversation back to themselves. A good conversationalist is someone who will listen to you and focus on you. Okay? And I'm pretty bad at that and I'm still working on it. But I'm trying to learn not to jump in, not to throw in my two cents. Let the other person talk. If somebody asks me, if they ask you, how did you sleep or whatever else, what happened to you, what, I don't know why they would ask you what you dreamed, but you never know. Then, yeah, answer. I'm working real hard on not giving my opinion on something unless I'm asked. Because that's a tendency, that's just a part of our self-centeredness, is we want to throw our opinion out there and say, well, let me tell you what I think. And the other person's thinking, well, I don't really care, I didn't ask. But if they're nice, they'll listen, you know. But those kind of things, just this, how does that tie together with what we were talking about earlier? I think if we engage in over-talkativeness and if we're always, again, focusing on self, then our guard tends to be let down. If we're so busy talking, then we make it harder to be vigilant and to be watchful. If we're too busy, we're not standing guard. Just like if you're driving, I do this all the time. I'm driving, I'm talking to somebody, and all of a sudden I realize, oops, I missed my exit. That's why, like in New York, they made all cell phones in the car illegal, not just handheld ones, but even because studies have shown that even if you talk on a hands-free cell phone in the car, because your attention and your concentration is focused more on the conversation than on the road, you're still just as likely to have a wreck as if you have one in your hand. I mean, most of us are fairly decent at driving with one hand. If you have a stick shift, that's really tough. But anyway, you understand my point? Just constant chattering focuses our attention on that, not so much on the temptations that are thrown at us, while we're chattering. Any thoughts on that? Questions?
I think one thing behind this being consumed by everything else in the world is the admonition in Thessalonians to pray unceasingly.
Yes.
And you can't do that if you're concerned with everything else.
That's right. Yeah, that ties in real well with this.
You also can't hear God if you're always talking.
Exactly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Silence.
Silence is something we need to cultivate more, all of us especially. It's funny, I actually wrote an article on this, and it was in the current St. Joseph thing, and Jennifer said to me, you went on for two pages about silence. the need for silence. And I said, yes, dear, but I wrote that. I didn't talk. I wasn't talking. But anyway, yeah, I mean, if you go in the Proverbs, there's more Proverbs about talking than anything else, I'm convinced. I haven't done a scientific study or anything. Maybe later. But
when you get finished talking.
Yeah, which could be, 10 years. I don't know. Anyway, all right, touche, thank you. I needed that. All right, we're having a lot of fun. All right, so we're almost done. Let's see, if we successfully guard our hearts against the attacks of the enemy, we must cultivate a spirit of humility. He talks about humility towards the end.
Where are we?
I don't know.
We're at the bottom of page 25?
We were. We're on 26 now. Okay, I skipped a paragraph, I'm sorry. I skipped that transitional paragraph. All right, look at the first full paragraph on 26. He says, "Do not seek higher posts and higher titles. The lower the position of service you have, the freer you are." There's a lot of truth in that. You know, the buck stops with the high-up guy. And right. I know that as the assistant priest, I have a lot less responsibility and a lot less work and a lot less stuff to deal with than Father Matthew does. "Be satisfied with the living conditions you now have. Do not be prompt to show your learning or skill." And again, here it is. Hold back your remarks. "No, it isn't so-and-so, but so-and-so. Contradict nobody and do not get into arguments. Let the other person always be right." That's tough. Never.
Especially when you're always right.
Yeah, you're always right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, harder for some of us than others. Isn't it? Sure.
Nor is hard to be humble. Yeah.
I feel the song coming on. "Never let your own will above set your own will above that of your neighbor. This teaches the difficult art of submission, and along with it, humility. Humility is indispensable. Take remarks without grumbling." This is hard too. "Be thankful when you are scorned, disregarded, ignored, but do not create humbling situations." And I love this. "They are provided in the course of the day as richly as you need." In other words, you know, you don't have to go out of your way to seek humbling experiences because, you know, they're going to come. My sister is currently substitute teaching, and she's going to start being a full-time regular teacher in the fall. And she was saying, you know, every time I go teach elementary, it really builds my self-esteem. You know, the kids just love me. They just, "Oh, we love you so much." Especially the lower grades, primary. And she says, "And then if I need my humility developed, if I need to be cut down to size, then I go do junior high." Or even high school sometimes. You know, when you get to high school, some of the kids know to keep their mouth shut, you know, but you know, in that junior high, especially 7th and 8th grade, you know, there is no concept of this thing about don't say what you're thinking, you know, keep your remarks to yourself. I'm not talking about all 7th and 8th graders, because there are exceptions. But for the most part, it's just like, you know, you want to be humbled, go substitute teach 7th grade or 8th grade, especially math, you know. So anyway, I guess one thing we should look upon humbling, at least when bad things happen to us, we should ask God, "What can I learn from this? What are you trying to teach me?" You know, or when somebody hurts us, the proper mentality is not to go into the corner and say, you know, "Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. Yes, I'm going to eat worms." You know, and that's hard not to do because it hurts. You know, it's like, yeah, it's hard to say, "Thanks, I needed that," but oftentimes we do need that. All right, what are your thoughts or questions on that? It's a good lesson. Tough one.
I have a comment. I think you have to have a counter argument to some of the positions that Philander takes for it to be a balanced class.
Okay, like what?
There's an elephant in the room right now, and that is, and I think people can sort of see or at least have some sense that it can, you know, Jefferson said that we are the guardians of our freedom, and it takes a certain amount of foresight, you know. It's when you were alluding to the fact that you had this idea of guarding your back, because the enemy could come in through the back if you're focused just on the front door. So, and that's what you're obviously maybe subconsciously seeing, that there has to be a counter argument to some of the positions that Mr. Philander takes. And he's not, you know, intuitively, we see the danger here, and that is that the system of government that was created here is very different than anything that was created prior. And it's a very young concept, but it allows men to be free and exercise free will. It's very easy for someone to use the concepts of Philander to steal men of their freedom. And that's that's the elephant in the room. So I think there has to be some, that has to be addressed. Some of the arguments, like don't pursue happiness, it can be misused. And the reason I can attest to that is because I grew up in Manuel Noriega's Panama. And so it's easy for men like Manuel Noriega to use the concepts of Mr. Colan to follow his own agenda and to control a population. So, and you have people like Kim Jong-il. So there's a danger there. And also, do not pursue higher learning, or that was discouraged in Manuel Noriega's Panama. Universities were closed.
He didn't say higher learning though.
But in the book, he did say not to seek higher positions.
Position, right?
There's a cautionary note that I'm a bit uncomfortable because I know what it was like to be under Manuel Noriega's boot. And I don't wish it upon anyone. So I think there's a danger there because he did use the church. He split the church in half because there were priests who were opposed to his ideas. And he took a priest and threw him out of a plane and said, you know, that's I can prove that angels don't exist.
Right.
Because that no matter how much he prays, no matter he opposed, so he was thrown out of a plane, and the Roman Catholic Church is still looking for his body.
Well, Grace, I agree with what you're saying. I don't think he's talking about things on a political level. He's talking about how we can develop our own spiritual life. Well, yeah, sure. Yeah, we have to be vigilant in the sense of watching out for our political freedom, too. Yeah, there's no question about that.
And it had a tremendous effect on me.
Right.
I mean, I was young when it happened, and I'll never forget it. And I wouldn't
wish it upon
anything. And the church can be used for a while, and then the priests start to disappear. So, something to think about.
Right. Well, why don't we go ahead and it's 1:15. That's a good thought. Let's go ahead and close in prayer. And we will have no class next time. It's Palm Sunday because we have our procession of palms afterwards. And then next time, obviously, is Pascha. So the next class will be 3 weeks from today on the 26th. Right? Yeah. Okay. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we thank you, O Lord, for your love for us. Help us develop a spirit of humility. Help us to develop a sense of being not centered entirely on ourselves, but on others. Help us to show the love of Christ to others. And I pray that you'd help us each as we are going into the final 2 weeks of our fasting, as we head toward Pascha. Help us to root out the pride, the ego, the selfishness within us, and to develop a true spirit of love for you. We ask in your name, the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, one God. Amen. All right, thanks, everybody. See you in 2 weeks. We'll see you before then. What's up?
Oh. Book in the
Okay. Left it in the car?
Left it in the car. Didn't do us a bit of good over here.
Well, you could have gone and got it.
Well, by then we were already late.
God okay. Bless. All right. God bless you.
Okay, Padre. See you later.
Take care. God bless.
I think we're going to go back to catechumen class. This one's a bit too challenging for me, I think. So. That's a good book. I want to go pick it up. We haven't got